Well, hi guys, welcome along to the last session of Tech Ed. I'm very impressed that you've all managed to come along, and I promise I won't keep you too late. Do have the prize draw here, which we'll do at the end of the session. I've got a confession to make to all of you guys. I'm lazy. I don't like to have to do anything more than once. Ask me to do it once, no problem at all. I hate going back and having to fix stuff, especially trivial stuff that I look at and think, oh, I should have got that right the first time. Because of this, I like to pay attention to helper methods and other people's code, stuff that can make the effort required to get my job done less, so I can get it done and I can go home on time, maybe even early on the odd occasion. So this is my focus in today's session, is to look at some of the helper methods and things that are in the .NET framework that can help you write one line of code instead of two or three or five. So I'm going to cover three areas in this presentation. I'm going to look at stuff that's in the core framework for .NET. I'm going to look at some third-party helper methods and libraries that can make your life a bit easier. And I'm going to showcase a few methods that I've picked up along the way that I've written myself from ideas and blog posts or just to meet my own need. And I'm hopeful that those will give you some inspiration where you can look at what you do day to day and think, I could write a helper method for that, and that's going to make life easier as we go forward. There are three things I'd like you to get out of this session. I'm hopeful that you'll see one thing that you know you can use. You can scribble the note down on a bit of paper on the back of your hand and go to work on Monday and use it. I'd also really be pleased if you find something that you think, that could be kind of useful, and at some point you give it a try, and it might or it might not be useful, but it's worth trying out. And it'd be really neat if you went away with the thought of, now there's one method I should write, because that'll probably be helpful. Are we clear? Good. I like an interactive audience. I have some prizes here from Mindscape. If I don't get a good question during the session, we'll do a draw, but some of the prizes might go for a good question during the session, so speak up. Scott Hanselman said this at Webstock this year, and that's another reason why I don't like to work too hard. It's using up my finite supply of keystrokes. So, let's start from the start and look at the way that data binding can work. We're going to start with .NET 2.0 and work our way forward. So this is your classic notifying property that we've been doing since .NET 2.0. And the key thing with it is that we have this magic string in the middle of the property change call, and it has to match the name of the property. Now, how many of you have had bugs in your code that trace back to having the string wrong? Yeah, that's about a third of you. It's really, really common. To support this, we have our classic property changed trigger method that triggers the event only if we have handlers associated. Pretty standard stuff. We've all seen it before. In .NET 3.5, with the introductions of lambdas and lambda expressions, this syntax became possible. We were identifying the property that's changed using a lambda expression. This means we don't have a magic string. It means if we type it wrong, it's going to get a compiler error, which is good. But it means that we need to have a slightly more complex method for onProperty changed that highlights, that triggers the event. Now, this is slightly complex, but basically what it's doing is it's drilling into that lambda expression to pull out the name of the property, and then it's firing the event as usual. The diagram at the bottom shows the object structure. I'm not going to go into too much detail today. Grab the slides from the TechEd download site or from my blog. The URL's coming up later if you want to drill into that. It works. It performs about the same as passing strings around. It's better. But now we can write things this way. Notice what's different in .NET 4, sorry, in .NET 4.5. We don't have the magic string in the property change call. Now, usually when I show this to people, they start saying, hang on, that can't possibly work. How can it know what property it is? How it works is by using this new attribute that the compiler recognizes. What we do is to declare the property parameter as a string parameter, as we have before. We give it a default value of null. Then we stick this attribute on, which asks the compiler to supply the value for us. And so that means this code here, if we go back to it, there we go. This code here automatically gets the right name for the property filled in by the compiler when it's all set up. If you actually use Reflector or .peek from ReSharper or any of the other tools to look at the code, you'll see the correct name is actually filled in the compiled code. Very useful. You like that one? Yep, good. Excellent. Okay, nullability, working with optional values. This was introduced in .NET 2. And the idea of it is that you can have a value that is either present or not present. So you can have an integer or a date time or some other value type that is perhaps not present. So it's mirroring the way that databases have always worked. And this is the code you sometimes see written to deal with that, where if the start has a value, then we'll use it, otherwise we'll default to 1st of January 1900. This is writing it the long way. What we can do instead is we can use the ternary operator and pull the value out. But that's still working too hard. What we can use instead is the what's called the null coalescence operator. This operator, if the left-hand side is null, gives you the value of the right-hand side, but if the left-hand side has value, it just returns it. So it fills in the blanks for you. Now, sometimes this can be inconvenient to use because you want to put it in the middle of another expression. Well, nullable types declare a getValue or default method that basically does the same thing as the null coalescence operator, but it's pre-wrapped in brackets and it's a pre-cast exception, not exception, expression. So that's another way to do that. Files and paths. How many of you have written code that needs to get to one of the so-called special folders in the file system? So the user's documents folder, the application settings folder, roaming profile settings. There's all sorts in the Windows folder, system folder. In .NET 4.0, this gets rather easy. They've finally given us a straightforward way to get to them. And the enumeration includes values for 64-bit as well. Path.combine has been around since .NET 1.1, and it joins together paths in the right way. It makes sure there's exactly one separator in place. So all of that code that we've written that does string manipulation for building paths, we really shouldn't have done it that way. Path.combine also does smart things. If the second path is not a relative path, it's an absolute path, it does the right thing in that case. New in .NET 4 is a helper method. It's just a new overload of path.combine that takes three parameters. Simple, but it works. How many of you had seen that one? Smattering of hands, this is good. Another one that's useful and has been around for a very long time is get full path. Now, I've seen code in a system that tried to work out the full path to a particular file by splitting the file path into its components and recognizing the dot dot goes up and handling symbolic links and hard links. And it was a really nasty method that didn't need to be written. Get full path will give you the full canonical path directly from the root of the hard drive to that particular file. It resolves parent directories, it resolves file links, it does all sorts of things, and it does it right. So you don't have to write the code, and that block that I mentioned, it was buggy. So we just replaced it with this, and all the bugs went away. Strings. String manipulation is something that we do a lot of in our code. Well, here's a couple of things to make it easy. If you ever needed to generate, say, a dividing line to print on the console or something like that, there's a constructor for a string that generates it. Saves writing the while loop when using a string builder and just does what you need. Here's another one from .NET 4. Joins a sequence of strings together, so it takes any enumerable of string and joins them together, just like using a string builder, just like writing the loop yourself, but it's there in the framework now. How many of you have done the whole to array and then string.join to achieve this in the past? Yep, here's an easier way there's now. Hold one moment. How's that? So we've had string.join for a while that takes an array. This one joins the enumerable of string together and puts the commas between them. Here's another, question. No, I haven't. It's not a problem I've come across. What you could do with that is to have the parameter value and use the null coalescence operator. So you'd have the value you're passing, question mark, and string.empty. It would be very nice if they did. They don't. Unfortunately, you should write that in a blog post somewhere and see if they pick it up for .NET 5, because a lot of these things that have come into the framework have been things that people have blogged about and people have picked up, and the guys at Microsoft have said, hey, that'll be useful, that'll save us time as well. This is true. Yep, the comment was that if they just silently handle nulls inside the method, then you're not going to get the opportunity that if something should never be null, you get the exception. So there's a policy thing coming in there as to whether you want the routine to handle it or not. Now, one of the ways to handle that kind of policy is to add an enumeration at the end, lets you specify that particular policy. But that starts getting into some interesting overloads and so on. Good question. Do you want a mega pack? Come and grab it after. Sweet. Okay. So we've had is null or empty in the .NET framework for testing a string for a while. But I've found in a bunch of my code when I'm dealing with user inputs that I need to check for if there's white space as well. So I end up with this two-part check that if it's null or empty, fail. Now if I trim it and it's null or empty, then I fail. Doing this all falls into a single call now with is null or white space. Again, a simple helper makes your code that little bit easier to read. Okay, link. All of this goodness that we got in .NET 3.5. There's more to it than just selecting and wearing or using the embedded link syntax. So, for example, on the enumerable static class, this is where all of the link to objects methods live. There's enumerable.repeat that lets you take a single item and turn it into a sequence. Sometimes useful, sometimes not, but often a useful building block for doing other things. So, for example, there's a new zip extension method in .NET 4. What this does is it takes two sequences of items and it combines the pairs of them together to give a new sequence. So in the case we've got here, we've got three names, Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and to each name, we suffix a semicolon and a space. We still end up with a sequence of three strings at the end, but each one of them has had the semicolon and space added to it, which opens things up, say, for a join in the next step. Take while is one that the statistics show isn't used very often, but it can be quite useful. So what this is going to do is it's going to find all of the players. Say we've got some sort of a football scoring system or league tables or something like that. Puts them in order by descending score, and then it's going to take everyone who scored more than 1,000 goals, points, tries, something, and it's going to discard the rest. So it takes the lead ones until the condition is false. If something else later in the list satisfies the condition, it still is discarded. It stops as soon as the condition is false. Anybody think they might have a use for that? Couple of nods. Excuse me. All right, jumping around a bit here, now looking at XML. This one's interesting because in .NET 2, we had a reasonably good framework for dealing with XML documents, but it turned out that it was kind of laborious to use. In .NET 3.5, they brought in a whole new framework to work with link. So we've got XDocument and XElement and XAttribute, and it's much easier to work with. In fact, it's easier to work with than most people who use it know. Have a look at this code. When we say element.attribute, it goes into that element and gets that particular attribute. And if the attribute doesn't exist, it returns null. Now, I've seen a lot of code that gets the attribute, and then if it's not null, we get the value out, and if it is, we do something else. And it's all about converting these attribute strings into particular types. Now, in fact, the guys who created the XAttribute class wrote some very useful casts in the code that take care of the whole deal of whether there is an element there, an attribute there, or not. So all we need to do is to cast the attribute for full name to a string. If there is an attribute, we get the value out. And if there's no attribute at all, we get a null. It does the right thing. So we get the same thing here. For the isAlive property, if the attribute isAlive is there, and it has true or false as the text, we get the Boolean out. If the attribute is missing, or it doesn't have true or false, we get an exception. It's doing the right thing. Have a look at the birth date. This is a nullable date time. So we've got three possible outcomes here. If there's no birth date attribute, we get a null. If there is a birth date attribute and it's a valid XML date literal, key point, then we get the date out. It does the right thing. If it's there but it contains gibberish, then we get an exception. It's doing the right thing. Now, for dates, you might want to do your own date handling, in which case you'd probably want to cast it to a string and then do some parsing and things. But for the most part, all of the common types, ints, bools, strings, date times, the casts are there to do the right thing. I took a body of code that was about 80 lines long, and I collapsed it into 5 lines using this. And in the course of doing that, I fixed 2 bugs that had been reported by end users. The key mantra that I'm coming back to time and time here is don't work too hard. If the code's there, reuse it, and then you don't have to debug it. Here's another one that's really useful. If you're familiar with working with XML documents, you're probably going to be familiar with XPath, allowing you to run interesting queries. Now, you can do them with link. You can do them a number of ways. You can write loops, nested loops, to try and find things. Or you can use XPath Evaluate that just does it. You start with some top-level root element, say the document or something you've already found, and execute the XPath, and you get back the results. And if the result you get back is a singleton, you can use the casts we just saw to change it from the element or the attribute into a date time or a string as you need. So you can really work with these XML documents very, very effectively. Any questions on that? It's a more esoteric one. No, we're good? All right. So ThreadLocal and Lazy are two new helper classes that can be quite useful. Let's start with Lazy. Ever had something in your code that you didn't need all of the time and was quite expensive to instantiate. Maybe it's a database connection, maybe it's a service connection, maybe it's some sort of cache of data off a file store, and sometimes you need it and sometimes you don't. The traditional pattern to make things perform better is procrastination. You put it off until you absolutely need it, and you do it in a just-in-time fashion. Now, it's really easy to do this in a property that checks to see whether we have it, and if it's null, we go and we get it and we set it. Lazy of T gives us a very straightforward way to do that in our code, and it makes it clearer as to exactly what's going on. We can actually now get rid of the wrapping lazy instantiating property and just use member.value wherever you want. Or you can keep the property and just keep things nice and simple. Where this really becomes useful is if you're writing multi-threaded code. Because you can just add this enumeration parameter to the constructor, and it will do the instantiation in a thread-safe way. Sweet. Have you ever tried to do thread-safe yourself? It's easy to make a simple mistake and get it wrong. Now we don't need to. So now we've got that, we can look at thread local. Now, at first inspection, you might look at this and think, can't we already do this? Because we can declare static members on our classes, and those static members we can decorate with the thread static attribute, and we get something pretty close to this. The difference is that a thread static, you have exactly one per thread. This is an object, so you get one per instance per thread. Gives you a finer grain of control. And it works pretty much in the way that the lazy does. You instantiate it and you get a value out of it. Is that a question? No? Okay. So that was a whirlwind tour of some of the ones that are in the framework. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to look at some of the ones that come from third parties. I'm going to look primarily, in fact I think only, because I cut this talk down a little bit, at some link extensions from John Skeet. Now, who's heard the name John Skeet? If you hadn't, you probably should. He's written a book called, C-Sharp and Depth. I was thinking C-Sharp Essentials, that's wrong now. C-Sharp and Depth, thank you. Very, very good book. He actually spends most of his time working with Java and Python. He works for Google. He's also the number one user on Stack Overflow. He's got an incredible score there, and his answers tend to be very, very good. He's almost slightly intimidating if you go to answer something on there and you find that he's answered as well. So John Skeet thinks that Link was incomplete, that there are some essential things that they could have had as a part of the Link framework, but didn't. So instead of just complaining about it, he wrote them, made them a project on CodePlex, and you can go and download them and use them. So the standard Link framework includes the max operator, which finds the highest value and gives you the highest value. So if you had a list of players, it would go through and tell you the player with the highest score scored 1,000 or 1,100. But it doesn't tell you who that player was. Max by goes through and does the same test, but instead of giving you the max value, it gives you the item from the list that has the max value. So if you're looking for the best player, you can go through the list once and find him or her, instead of having to do one scan to find the highest score and another scan to find the player with the highest score. Another one that he's provided is a concat function. And this is based on the idea from a lot of functional languages where it's really easy to, the term they use is cons, to create a new sequence by adding something onto the start. So here we've got a set of three ducks, and we have another duck, and we want to create a sequence of four ducks by adding another one onto the start of the sequence. Straightforward to do, but with the concat method, you do it in one line instead of having to futz around with strings and things. Lists and things. Another one to look at. On the list of T class, there is a for each method that will iterate through everything in the list and carry out an action for every item. But that's on the list. For the enumerable of T, there's nothing that will iterate through. So it seems to be a bit of a hole, and there's good arguments why you might not want it. In fact, the Link team did consider it and decided it was a bad idea, but John Skeet wrote it for us anyway. So this is an eager method. As soon as it gets to here, it iterates through the entire list, it applies the function to each one, and it returns void. It doesn't return anything. So it's really useful to put at the end of a sequence of statements when you've got the ones you want and you want to do something for each of them. It saves wrapping it all in a for each. It sometimes makes things more natural to read, makes them flow in an easier to read fashion. Sometimes, though, you want something that's lazy, that will do something to each item without changing it, so that you can look on it on the way past. And for that purpose, we have the pipe function. So you stick this in, and it applies an action to each item as it's pulled through the sequence. It doesn't change the item. It's not like a select, which can give you a different return. The item that goes in is the item that comes out. But on the way through, it carries out this action. Now, the key place that I've found this to be incredibly useful is if I've got myself a 12-line link expression and I'm not getting the right results. I can stick these pipes in the middle and log what comes through at each point and start partitioning the sequence down to see where the problem is. Where are the things getting filtered out? Where are they not being filtered out? So a very, very useful debugging tool. Also has uses elsewhere, but that's just where I found it to be particularly helpful. Now, a few DIY extensions. These are ones that I've collected off blogs or I've written myself. They're not in the framework. They're not nicely packaged up in CodePlex. I'm going to post these slides on my blog with all of the code there so you can nab them if you want to use them. As we look at these, I want you to start thinking about the code base you work with and whether or not you might find some similar methods to extract from your code base to make things easy to use. So most of my code lives in-house. I write rich client applications that have a dozen users inside my organization. I'm not writing applications for distribution, nor am I writing websites. So I know my target audience. In fact, I can name my target audience in a lot of cases. It bugs me when a bit of software says, you're about to delete one person's. You know, the grammar grates. You know, I have pride in my work. I want things to come out with the right grammar in my messages. So this simple as count method does the right thing to describe what goes in with the right term. Now, it's not something that's of use if you're doing a website, if you're doing anything that needs globalization or internationalization, because the rules for singular and plural get a lot more complicated. There are languages where it's different for one versus two versus many, different for zero versus two versus many. It gets really, really complicated. I started reading some blogs about it. My brain just about exploded. But if you're doing something in-house, which is what the majority of developers do, then this can be helpful. This is how you would use it. Now, you'll note here that I've included the space in both strings. An earlier version of this method had the space in the method, and you just supplied what they were, and in some cases, it wasn't the right thing to do, so I changed it. Now, here we have a couple of methods for dealing with exceptions. Now, exception handling is tricky. Not only do you need to catch the right kind of exception, but doing the right thing with it is important. One of the things that I've seen in too much code is code that logs the main exception that's thrown, but it throws away the inner exceptions. So it does the logical equivalent of saying, it broke, and denies me as a troubleshooter, as someone trying to provide third level support, denies me the knowledge I need to know exactly where it broke. Now, digging into these inner exceptions can be a bit of a pain, so I wrapped it all up into an extension method that digs through the inner exceptions and digs down and digs down and digs down and turns them into a simple sequence. If you're starting to use the task parallel framework, you'll find there's an aggregated exception there, which can have, instead of a single inner exception, can have a whole list. And I have a variant of that method that goes through all of the buried inner exceptions and handles the aggregated exception as well. It's kind of scary source code, so I didn't think I'd put it in the deck, but it's certainly easy enough to do. Now, here's another one. Notice here we've got something, we've got exception.data. Okay? Put up your hand if you know about exception.data and you use it in your code. So we've got about three hands went up. Every exception in the .NET framework has .data, and it's a dictionary of key value pairs. And you think, big deal. But a lot of the key exceptions that we get and we catch and we deal with populate this. So for example, if you get a SQL exception coming out of your code, there's a name value pair that tells you the actual SQL that was run that gave the exception. There's other details there as well. I discovered this and I thought, geez, I've been throwing away data for all of this time. So what I've done is I've wrapped it all up in this exception as strings method. The first thing it returns is the actual string, the actual message of the exception. And then if there's a dictionary of data there, it goes through and it pulls out all those name value pairs and returns those as well. Now, doing this improved the diagnostics I was getting out of my systems incredibly, because there's so many exceptions that get thrown that have this data and I was just throwing it away. Now, there's one caveat here. You'll notice I'm checking to see that it's not null. The execution engine exception, the out-of-memory exception, and the stack overflow exception, and the thread abort exception all have this as null. So you have to check that it's there before you start iterating through. If you throw a null exception in the middle of handling another exception, your application will go like a bubble, and it will disappear, and there will be no evidence as to what happened. And that's the worst thing to try and debug. So taking these two extension methods, so we'll go back, we've got the as enumerable, which takes the exceptions and splits them all out, undoes the nesting, and following that with the as strings, we can end up with a fairly simple bit of logic to log all the details of an exception to my logging framework. Now, I've got to confess, this code is wrong, because in actual fact, it should just say logger.exception and pass the exception, and all of this code should be inside my logger, because I'm going to need to reuse it all over the show. But it made more sense for the slide to put it here directly. So I hope you forgive the fuzziness, I should say. Okay, so this all makes sense? Moving on. Here's another one that runs into problems with code. Say we've got some sort of customer relationship management system, and on screen we need to show for the concierge in the hotel or the reception in the hotel, or maybe we're behind the bar. But someone comes up and swipes their player card, say we're at a casino, and they need to see on screen what sort of membership this player has. Are they a regular member? Are they a gold member? A platinum member? Are they, you know, black gold or whatever the top rank is? You know, this is the sort of person you make wait, or do you give them priority service? So in the code, we go and we grab the membership description. So we go from the person to the object that represents their membership, to the object that represents the membership type, and we grab the description because we want to throw it on screen. The problem is, any one of these things might be null. And we don't want our code to blow up. You know, the guy behind the bar doesn't want to be troubleshooting his computer. He wants to be pouring drinks. He wants to be listening to tales of woe. This is what bartenders do. They're not IT guys. So the traditional way to handle this is you write this cascading set of tests. First, you make sure you've got a person. Then you make sure you've got a membership. Then you make sure that membership has a type so we don't have any dodgy data. And if it all works, we go through the whole sequence again. Who finds this code easy to read? Okay, I look at this, and it takes me a few seconds to parse it to know what's going on. And one of the drawbacks is we're going through this list of this traversal of the association multiple times. Now, it's not going to take long. If they're well-behaved properties, they'll return their information quickly. But, you know, if you've got a heavily loaded system, taking 100 cycles to do something that can be done in 10, it can make the difference on load of the system, and you might need to upgrade earlier. So writing efficient code is important. Well, here's a couple of extension methods to work on this to make it easier. They've got odd names, and we'll see why in a minute. So here's the first one. It's called with. Now, it's nothing to do with the Delphi or the VB with. Just seems to make sense as a name from terms of use of English. So what it does is it takes some input object and it takes a function that'll convert that object to another value. Now, if the value we start with is null, it gives us a null. Otherwise, we evaluate the function. Okay, bear with me. Another routine called return. Very similar. It again has a little conversion thing, but instead of just returning null, it has a default value to return if the input value is null. Curious looks on faces. Here we go. Here's the payoff. We can now write code like this. We say, we have a person, and with that person, give me the membership. And if the person was null, give me null. So now we might have a membership. With that membership, give me its type. But if it's null, give me null. And now I've got a membership type. Give me its description. And if I don't have a membership type, give me an empty string. We only traverse the objects once. The code is more efficient. And equally importantly, once you're used to the method names, and that is a big if, once you're used to it, this is easy to read. And I certainly think this is easier to read than what we had a few slides back than that. Now, they're odd method names, and they can throw people at first, but it can also be helpful. So depending on your environment, depending on your team, may or may not be a good idea. This is the sort of thing you can easily do with some good helper methods. They came out, I have, and for the example I had, which was going about 5 levels deep, performance was basically the same. Within statistical significance, the differences weren't significant. And that was primarily, I think, because the older style, like this, was drilling in so many times that while each drill in was quite efficient, it was doing a lot more of them. So the version we had here under the hood is doing a few more tests, and each step is a little bit slower. But because we're doing fewer steps, it seemed to balance. Readability is a big part of it as well. And if any of the properties you're dealing with actually do something nasty, like going to a database and not caching the result, then this will definitely be better. Although I would suggest that if that's the case, then you probably should go and fix the property so it caches it. Any other questions or thoughts? I've kept this presentation short for you all since it's the last session of the conference. So here's the summary. Looked at three areas, a quick sweep through some of the ways that the framework has had new helper methods put in that you can make good use of. We looked at a third-party library, the MoreLink library from John Skeet, and the way that it can make things easier for you. And we looked at a couple of interesting cases where some DIY methods can make things easier. So here's the goals that I wanted you to hopefully go away with. I hope you've got something in mind. If you want to get a hold of me, I guess the related sessions don't really matter. I put that together before I knew I was in the last slot. If you want to get a hold of me, here's the details. I'll be putting my notes, my slides, including speaker notes, up on my blog for you to download. The slide decks that you download from TechEd themselves have the speaker notes all scrubbed, but there's nothing in there that would be a problem, so I'm going to put my slides up with speaker notes. And don't forget your evaluations and all of that stuff. Should skip that one. You've seen this a million times. Thank you all for coming. Shall we do some prize draws? I need a volunteer to draw a card.